Thank you for choosing this ABC Radio National podcast. When it's finished, we'll have details on other informative and entertaining programs you may be interested in. But right now, here's your podcast.
Hello from Stephen Crittenden. Welcome to the Religion Report. This week, the former Prime Minister and Foreign Minister of Haiti, Claudette Worley, joins us. But first, the Sydney Anglican Synod is meeting this week, and a lot of people are waiting to see whether it will agree to allow the debate on women's ordination to be reopened after a moratorium which has lasted for well over a decade. During that time, the movement for the ordination of women has been silenced and demoralised in Sydney, while the rest of the Anglican Church in Australia was ordaining women priests and then women bishops. But a couple of Saturdays back, MOW took to the steps of the Sydney Town Hall in a demonstration that marked the return to the fray of Dr. Patricia Brennan, who was spokesman for the movement in the 1980s.
25 years ago, at this hour, on this date, a small group of women and men gathered outside St. Andrew's Cathedral to put the church on notice that a great wrong was being done in the name of Christ, in supposed defence of the Bible and true religion. I was there and stand here again as an Anglican of the Sydney Diocese who refuses to accept that the subjugation of women to men is mandatory to the Christian faith. Its expression in church structures excludes women from the priesthood, from leadership, and from theological conjecture. Tonight, the Sydney Movement for the Ordination of Women will shortly affirm that stance in a meeting at Chapter House, where we will celebrate the ministry of those women I mentioned. History will record what kind of difference women will make. These, our sisters, unlike us, have been extended the charitable assumption that they have the same right to make the same mistakes as men and to test their calling. We live in a city where the ecclesiastical leadership of both cathedrals, Catholic and Anglican, uphold the equivalent, I believe, of Sharia law when it comes to gender, sexuality, and human rights. If this matter only affected the church, I would not be standing here tonight in the Sydney Town Hall. But as a forensic physician, I daily see the tragic consequences of patterns of gender and violence that dominate this sad world. We happy few dare to claim that we follow in the steps of Luther, of Galileo, and of Bonhoeffer, who were rejected by the church because they put people and evidence over dogma and clerical power. MOW's task is a more humble one, to continue in the task of convincing the church to repent and to do unto others as they would have them done unto them. Now it's the Reverend Keith Mascood.
I stand here today as a male Anglican priest of the Diocese of Sydney, a member of Holy Trinity, Dulwich Hill, ordained a priest in 1985. I speak as one who all those years ago believed that the scriptures were clear that only men should lead congregations, women should be submissive and quiet. I stand here today as someone who has come to see that there are better ways of reading the Jewish and Christian scriptures, more intellectually consistent and satisfying ways, ways that take better account of all that we know. I stand here today as the former head of the ministry department at Moore Theological College, where I taught for 10 years full-time and for 5 years part-time. Surprisingly, maybe, many who taught there, past and present, no longer believe or now suspect but are unwilling to say that neither the scriptures nor God stand in the way of women becoming priests and bishops and archbishops. Amen. I stand here today as someone who has begun hearing that things are changing. Winds of change have begun to blow, not loudly enough, but the wind is blowing. I've heard this from bishops and archbishops, archdeacons and senior clergy here in Sydney. I've heard it whispered in the corridors of Moore College. I've heard it from many, many lay people who frankly are puzzled, baffled by the way of being towards women. It makes no sense of their experience of life in a 21st century world. People throughout this diocese are beginning to ask questions about a way of reading scripture that, if it was consistently followed, would mean that we would also need to believe in a young earth, a flat earth, a gigantic flood that inundated the earth just a few thousand years ago. We've learned some things in the last few years about the world, about cosmology and geology and anthropology, that simply must be factored into any intelligent reading of the scriptures. I stand here today as someone who keeps hearing stories of women being told to be quiet, to stop exercising their gifts, that women can't do that because God says so. Women who are being hurt, women who are being diminished, women who are being marginalized, who are leaving the church in droves because of mistreatment in the name of God and of an unsustainable way of reading the Bible. I'm here today as the National Chaplain of Mission Australia, an organization filled with talented leaders who are women. That hardly bears saying, it's so unsurprising. I am here today to honour the movement for the ordination of women. I stand in solidarity. I stand in support. I stand in admiration for those like Patricia Brennan who have, against the trend here in Sydney, fought and struggled for what they believe and I believe is right. This church will change. In 25 years from now, we will not be standing here in protest, but in celebration.
The Chaplain of Mission Australia, Keith Mascord, addressing a demonstration in favour of women's ordination on the steps of the Sydney Town Hall earlier this month. And Dr. Patricia Brennan joins us now. Patricia, after 14 years, what's brought you back to MOW and brought MOW back to the Town Hall steps?
Well, I think the thing that's provoked it is movement in Synod again after what was an effective moratorium. I said when the moratorium was declared back in the early 90s, this will be the death of the discussion. This is the intention not to have this discussion. It never was had.
By moratorium, you mean there's been a moratorium on further discussion of women priests?
Yes, the statement was made that this is damaging women having this debate, so we don't want to damage and hurt women, so they had an official moratorium where it could not be debated in Synod. I believe that if that happened, it would kill the discussion anyway, which it did. So that change, I think, has come about purely by time and by the state of the diocese now being worse than it was when we opened the debate in the 80s.
Now, Synod is meeting this week.
Indeed.
What are we expecting is going to happen? What are the possibilities?
A lone priest called Chris Albany will once again stand in that very entrenched Synod and be listened to by a whole batch of new Synod people and simply ask his brothers and sisters, isn't there a case here for treating people better? He's going to ask the Synod to adopt the same tolerance towards an alternate position in Sydney that they've asked the rest of the church in the world to adopt towards them. So they're asking Lambeth to tolerate this group of people who are holding out. And Chris is going to say, well, if you're asking the international church to accept your position, why are you oppressing those within your midst who don't have your position? You know, it's very close to the parable where the man who was forgiven a lot went out and punished the person who he only had to forgive a little. I think the Sydney Diocese is being challenged by some pretty important parables.
What's different this time around, socially and politically, for women? I mean, is this going to be another campaign you're going to lose gloriously, or is this a campaign you can win?
Well, I think what's changed is that we are now very, very subject to the media. And I think that when the present regime in the church got in Sydney, they did a big job on the media, and they've done it very successfully. You don't see much written by people who are self-referenced and radical at the moment in the papers. And when you read the online stuff that's coming out of the Anglican Church, it is appalling by terms of human rights and intellect and justice. The movement for the ordination of women probably doesn't have the capacity or the kind of prophetic presence at the moment to talk about winning anything. But I think when one person stands up and tells the truth, then all the people perhaps who've got a gut feeling that that might be the truth might actually listen. And I think there are many movements within the Sydney Diocese that don't have a face or a name yet, including one that does have is Anglicans Together. That's always interested me, that is the way Anglicans resist dominant authority. They gather together and have internal discussions and meetings. I would hope that some of those people might stand up. And then there are a lot of people in congregations who I think if they could only hear what the problem is, and if they could only experience women, there wouldn't be a problem.
Keith Mascord was on the town hall steps with you, the chaplain of Mission Australia, who 2 years ago wrote an open letter in which he said the Sydney Anglicans were in danger of becoming a cult, a conformist cult. Here he is now standing beside you, talking about the possibility that the winds of change are actually even blowing through the corridors of Moore Theological College.
The doors and
windows. How real is that?
I think the doors and windows are fairly firmly shut, though. And I think also people need to look at the history of any institution, religious or otherwise. If you look at the Sydney scene, there's a triad of the cathedral, the theological college, which generates ideas and ministry, and the kind of machinery that runs the diocese, like the archbishop, the bishops, and the standing committee. Those are all in collusion. They've got a leadership that is sworn to loyalty and conformity. And I think it's extremely hard to stand over and against it and stay inside of it. So there's this big argument, do you change this system from inside or do you change it from outside?
It's often been put to me that if there's ever an explosion in the Sydney diocese, it will come completely out of nowhere in the form of a theological dispute at Moore Theological College. Keith Mascord seems to be hinting that there's a bit of rumbling going on even there. I mean, how real is that?
Well, we'll find out, won't we? Because we're looking at a diocese that has been led by a kind of a Pied Piper model, where you follow. What happens when you refuse to follow? Well, we're going to find out how many will refuse to follow. I respect the right of people to lead. What I don't respect is those people who know better and who follow.
How important was it to have Keith Mascord standing up on the steps with you as a male priest in the Anglican diocese who'd in fact taught at Moore College, saying, I've changed my position, I'm standing with the women now?
Well, I think it was important for him. I personally feel when people start paying a heavy price, I'll be interested. Keith is no longer in the Anglican system. If he was still in Moore College, it would be superb. But by definition, most people who think that way leave. And that is my contention. If you keep on, I don't mean staying in the pew or staying in the lecturing system, but staying in the discussion and not giving up. It's so easy to feel overwhelmed when a dominant culture takes over and has the machinery. And it's so easy to stop saying you're wrong. But it's a long haul. This thing took about 70 years to get where it is. I think it'll take another generation, maybe the teenagers now. And maybe religion itself is going to take some huge changes with the changes in the media and the kind of global discussions, like economy at the moment. Imagine if there was a real discussion about those in religious power on the same level as, you know, there's panic stations, let's address this problem globally.
On the same level as there is about the people running our markets globally.
Absolutely. People running our ideas.
Thank you very much for being on the program.
Thanks, Stephen, for having me.
Dr. Patricia Brennan, and on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, online and on your pod, this is the Religion Report. A former Prime Minister and Foreign Minister of Haiti, Claudette Worley, was in Australia recently in her new role as Secretary General of the Catholic peace organisation Pax Christi. Pax Christi was created out of the ashes of the Second World War. One of its architects was Cardinal Giuseppe Roncalli, who later became John the 23rd. And in those days, it focused on dialogue between the people of France and Germany. In the early 1990s, after the fall of the brutal dictatorship of Baby Doc Duvalier, a Catholic priest, Jean-Marie Aristide, became president of Haiti, and Claudette Worley served as his foreign minister and social affairs minister from 1990 to 1995, and then briefly as prime minister in 1995-96. This was also a time when liberation theology in Latin America was coming under sustained attack. And in this interview, Claudette Worley speaks about the auto-demolition of liberation theology in Haiti by the Catholic hierarchy led by Archbishop François Wolfe Ligand. But we began by talking about Claudette Worley's tour of the Asia-Pacific. She's been looking at the work being undertaken by Pax Christi members in our region, including opposition to military build-up in the Pacific, concern for the plight of indigenous communities, and dialogue for peace in the Philippines.
In Philippines, because they have had war and the war is still, in a way, present, you know, so that means that they are very focused on education for peace and also tolerance and dialogue and have interfaith approach on that. When we go to Japan, for example, Recently, they have put a lot of emphasis on working to preserve Article 9 of the Constitution to make sure that Japan not only will not go to war, but also to maintain, you know, the issue of not spending their money on weapons and so on. You know, so that is what it is more important for them at the moment. And we have been accompanying them and working with them on that field, you know.
I think Pax Christi in this region has been placing some emphasis on campaigning about its concern about military build-up in the Pacific.
Absolutely, absolutely. This is one of the main issues. And precisely if I am here now and it coincides with the annual meeting of the organization, it's precisely an occasion for me to listen to the different players and understand better what they are working on or working with, so that after that, when I go back to Brussels, I could be of better use to them in that work. Mm.
As I understand it, another big issue for the region...
Climate,
but also the effect on indigenous people and a whole raft of issues relating to indigenous people.
Absolutely, absolutely. This is one of the issues I would say that both Australia and also New Zealand have put in the forefront of one of the issues that Pacifica International as such has to work for. But we have a lot of people interested in that, let's say in Latin America, where, for example, a lot of indigenous people for a long time were totally deprived, you know, of their rights. But now...
In Mexico and Guatemala and so on.
All over. And now they are asserting themselves more and more. Yes.
Mm. Let's just talk about your own homeland and your own region.
Okay.
I've always been very interested in what's become of liberation theology in Latin America and the Caribbean. Mm. How important was liberation theology on shaping your movement in Haiti, but also on your own thought?
Absolutely. In the 70s, I was Secretary General of Caritas Haiti. And it was precisely the moment where Puebla, you know, the bishop met in Puebla and in Medellin.
This is the famous bishops' conference.
That's right.
In what year? Was it 1979?
Yeah. That's right. So that means that this has been a commitment of the bishops where they have taken the preferential option for the poor. That is not only appealing to us, but it was directly related to the situation in Haiti. Our people are the poorest among the poor. What is important during that time is that also during Vatican II, the Catholic Church has called on us to go back and incorporate our culture, which means in a country like Haiti, for the first time in history, people are going to have mass, the whole liturgy in Creole, which means this is the language that they know, that they understand. And it was not only that. For the first time, the drum, for example, that was perceived and said before something satanic, pagan, is being rehabilitated. A priest had made a song saying that this is a beautiful instrument of music. So it is made by God. It doesn't belong to Satan. So that means that people started to use songs in Creole with the drum. So it was totally different situation in our church. People would come in the church and sing and dance, and it was joyful. And also, because this is the time that with liberation theology, we started to build up and to set up some little church, community level. Then that means that it wasn't only, religion was not only practiced when people go to church, but when people get together. So we have community of people trying to live as the first apostle, the first community church, sharing ideas, sharing goods, working together, etc. For me, that was the most beautiful time, not only politically because it empowered the people, but also for the church because the church was very, very lively at that time.
And is that liveliness gone? Obviously, in the 70s, that was the high point of liberation
That's
theology.
Right. And
we often hear that it's pretty much over. Is it still healthy and alive?
Not so much. It's not at all the same. And I think that a lot of people, at least in Haiti, have lost the trust and the confidence that they had in the church at that time. And I'm going to explain why. In Caritas, for example, we were working in education, we were working in relief, providing assistance to people, but we were also helping them organize themselves, women's organization, peasants organization, union, etc. Another structure of the church was working with radio. So we had Radio Soleil bringing the news to people, not only the news, the good news of, let's say, religion, but also news. People knew what was going on next door in the other community, but they knew what was going on in Latin America and elsewhere. So that means that has helped people make a big leap in history. So that means that people who were totally uneducated now could know and understand. And because precisely the message that we were giving at that time, that if people were poor, it's not because just had decided or that they had to be poor and remain poor, but that they themselves had to be part of the creation, had to take responsibility for their life, that they should be part of it. A lot of poor people adhere to it and became very active in that sense that it gives them dignity. In a country like Haiti, where most of the people were totally repressed and considered as second-class citizens. So that means that for the first time, they were recognized as people who could do something. So there was a lot of creativity in art, in all domains, you know. Unfortunately, and I have to put a third pillar because the Justice and Peace Commission of the Catholic Church also worked like that. So that means that we were different organizations, but all of us were interconnected and we would meet together with the bishops. So that means that to bring the voice of the people and all the pastoral letters at that time, if you read them in the 80s, you will see that it reflects totally, you know, what was going on, let's say, in the country.
So the bishops were giving their support, as they were in Brazil and other places?
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah.
And was it killed off?
Yes, unfortunately. In 86, for example, the bishop created Mission Alpha, a big literacy program. When they decided to do so, that was after the overcome of President Duvalier, the son, you know, Jean-Claude, Baby Doc. So Baby Doc left in February. School normally start in Haiti in October. So school had started, but there was a lot of political turmoil. People didn't go to school. And a lot of young students from secondary school and also the university propose to the government to stop, not to go back to class right away, that all of them would go and train people to know how to write and read. I was told that someone at that time told the president of the bishop conference, be careful, that's how it started in Cuba. And the bishop themselves back down because they were afraid of communism. Mission Alpha was stopped, and not only Mission Alpha, but Radio Soleil, Caritas, all over. You would see slowly the bishop change the personnel to put other people who were not associated as being from the left or with the left. This is a very sad story. This is the same movement that brought Aristide to power in 1990. And it is not by accident. It is a priest of the poor, working with young people and with the poor, very critical of the government, very critical of the military, very critical of the repressive system, the Tonton Macoute, precisely because of that. the people identified themselves with him and brought him to power. But Aristide was not only critical vis-à-vis the regime, he was very critical also of his own church, the hierarchical
church.
Church and the institution. And it was not only Aristide, it was also a lot of young people, including, I remember, people from Port-au-Prince asking Vatican to take away one of the bishop or the archbishop if they wanted to have it in Rome, but this wasn't the bishop we wanted. And they wanted the people of God to be consulted for the next bishop. The response that we got at that time from one of the bishops of Haiti, yeah, but Catholic Church is not a democracy. You have to realize it is two different concepts of church, what is being church. With the liberation theology, the emphasis is put on the people of God. So it is the community, it is the people of God who are the church. And people felt and started, because they knew that, started to ask the church what they wanted, you know, to tell the bishop what they were expecting from them. But in reality, and for almost 2,000 years, we have a Catholic Church which is universal, and it is very well structured. The Catholic Church is very vertical and very dominantly structured. So you have all these, the bishops, and below the bishops, you have the priests, and below the priests, you have the nuns and the brothers, and then after that come the lay people. You know, so
do you think that the clash between those two models mm-hmm. was the real reason? You know, back at the time, mm-hmm. there was a lot of talk about liberation theology being Marxist and being in favour of class struggle.
It is difficult for me to go to that because I cannot say that I have studied enough both Marxism and liberation theology in that sense to look at them to see what is common or not. I know that this is what has been said, you know. I am still convinced that it was a clash between two different concepts of religion, you know.
Of ecclesiology.
That's right. And I do understand why a religion which has been there for 2,000 years would want, you know, to at least maintain the reins of what it is. Because otherwise, the Catholic Church being in Latin America, the vast continent where there are more Catholic people, so things could escape, you know, could not be totally manageable, certainly not from Rome. And I think that things would have been totally different if they had let it grow. I think it is unfortunate because what I have seen and what I can make a testimony of, the liberation theology that I know of and that I have experienced and that I believe in because I still see myself as part of it, is it about social justice? It's not about war. And why should we let only the communists to think about repairing all the inequity and injustices that are in the world? I think it is the mission of the church to help us live as brothers and sisters. That is what we are saying. And brothers and sisters are not only raised to share, but I know in my family, if I would want to take everything for myself, my mother would intervene or my father to say that you have to share with your brother. Because that is what brotherhood is about. It's about sharing. It's about love. And normally, the Church of Christ, that is the message that we have received from Christ. So I think that, unfortunately, some people in power are putting the emphasis on the wrong values. That is my opinion.
Well, we've had two remarkable women on the program today, Dr. Patricia Brennan, and there we heard the Secretary General of Pax Christi International, Claudette Worley. That's all this week. Thanks to John Diamond and Nadia El Ghorli. Goodbye till next week from Stephen Crittenden.
You've been listening to another Radio National podcast. And now you've got a chance to have your voice heard on Radio National's Encounter program by going to pool.org.au. Pool is Radio National's new collaborative online site where audiences become makers. The Art Heart Project asks the artist amongst you what happens when you create. Is inspiration a religious experience for you? Do you have a muse? If you're a composer, performer, dancer, writer, we'd love you to show us how spirituality influences your work. The best contributions will also be featured on the Encounter website or broadcast in a program later this year. For all the details, go to pool.org.au and look for Art Heart.